Hi, welcome back to Reading and Drinking on the Psalm TV Podcast Network. This is Jill Zamorski, and we have another book for you this week. Today, I am going to be talking about a book entitled The Widow Clicquot, The Story of a Champagne Empire and the Woman Who Ruled It by Tilar Mazzeo. I think I pronounced that correctly. So there's a lot in this book to quote. And one of the first things that I underline in this book is just something that makes me giggle every time I read it. So I want to start off this way. It is a beautiful and delicate wine. And above all, it is a wine associated with women. It has been ever thus. The poet Lord Byron famously proclaimed that lobster salad and champagne were the only things a woman should ever be seen eating. Byron was an unrepentant chauvinist, but it's still a delicious idea. And I'm down for it, because you know what? It's lunchtime, and I feel like if my lunch were lobster salad and champagne, I would be making good life choices today.
This episode is sponsored by Study Hall, my show on Psalm TV, where you can learn the ins and outs of being a sommelier and get helpful hints and tips for studying for your exams. Not a subscriber? Well, you can get a year of Psalm TV for 50% off with the code STUDYHALL. That's all one word, Study Hall, and you'll get a year's subscription for only $25.
Now, a little bit of a disclaimer. I've mentioned this before, but for the past 5 years, I have represented not only the wines of Veuve Clicquot, but all the champagnes that are part of the Moët Hennessy portfolio. And actually, some of them are mentioned in this book, but I just like to put that out there. But this book has been around for a while. This book was published in 2008. I have a paperback copy. It's like 5x7. And the book just screams champagne. The color of the book is the famous color of Veuve Clicquot's yellow label champagne. It's sort of, well, the French term is jaune d'œuf. It means the yellow of an egg, or like the color of a really good like farm egg yolk, not the grocery store kind, but like farmer's market eggs. And there is a shape of a bottle of champagne, like a silhouette. And then you see part of a picture of Madame Clicquot. And then there's of course bubbles because it's champagne. This book is paperback, the one I have, and it's deceptively short. It's 191 pages. That said, there are about 60 additional pages of notes and bibliography and index, because as the author points out in the beginning of this book, and I'll give you a little time frame for when Madame Clicquot, you know, was alive, late 18th century, and she lived, you know, nearly 90 years. So through, you know, a good chunk of the 19th century. But at this time, when she was, you know, settling into her adulthood and getting married and then ultimately taking over the family champagne business, the lives of, you know, entrepreneurs and commercial innovators, they didn't really make history books. And this was especially true if those entrepreneurs or innovators happened to be women. And so one of the real struggles in putting together this book is that while, you know, Madame Clicquot, Barbe Nicole Ponsardin Clicquot, her full name, while she was, this is one of my favorite French adjectives, formidable, a formidable and independent woman, she built this champagne maison into really everything that it is. Largely in her day, you know, especially in her early life, like there just aren't records of it, which is kind of sad, but it is the time that she was living in. So the way that this book is organized is chronologically. It starts off in her childhood and her youth. You know, some of the details are certainly pieced together, and there's frequently mentions from the author of certainly, you know, Barbe Nicole would have enjoyed this, or certainly she and her husband would have had this book. Some of these things we don't know for a fact, but given who they were, what the resources they had at their disposal, and you know, obviously the industry they're involved in, I think some of these assumptions are reasonable to make. But first, a little backlog. So Veuve Clicquot, let's just get this out there. I'm a big believer in pronouncing things correctly. And one of the things I often talk about, because talking about champagne is a big part of my real day job, is that for most champagnes, not all of them, but for most champagnes, the name on the bottle is somebody's last name, sometimes even their first name. And so I am a big believer that it's important to pronounce somebody's name correctly. So Clicquot is her married name. Her maiden name was Ponsardin, and Veuve Clicquot is how the wine is referenced now. And Veuve is the French word for widow. She was in fact widowed at a very young age in her early 20s, at age 27 in 1805. And it's not really detailed so much in the history of this book, but by virtue of my job, I have been to the Maison multiple times. And I also have, you know, obviously done a great deal of research on my own. And one of the reasons, and really the main reason why this wine is called Veuve Clicquot, is that at that time in France, women didn't enjoy necessarily all of the rights that they enjoy today. They were certainly second-class citizens, even rich ones like Madame Clicquot. And so the name of the winery became Veuve Clicquot as an homage to her, but also to indicate that while in that day, women couldn't necessarily have bank accounts in their own name or weren't counted in censuses or certainly couldn't vote. She was running what became, you know, an international champagne empire. And so that was her way of kind of signifying to people out there like, hey, it's cool. There's no man's here. He passed away, but I've got things on lockdown. And so it is probably one of the most mispronounced champagnes out there. Most people say Veuve. It's Veuve. It rhymes with love. Like, we love champagne because we do here at SOM TV. So the beginning of this book talks all about Madame, well, before she was Madame Glicquot, when she was just Barbe Nicole. And her family was one of the wealthiest families in the city of Reims, which is sort of the major commercial capital of the Champagne region. And it's where the Maison is located today. It's where a lot of famous champagne houses are located. Her family was really wealthy. And at this time, champagne wasn't so much known for the quality of their wines. It was a major textile production area. So like cloth, woolens and linens and things of that nature. And right about this time in her youth, and she had a younger sister and she also had a brother. She and her sister were at kind of like a fancy boarding school. And this is about the time when the French Revolution was coming to a head. And there is a little bit of information about how her father was pretty savvy and really kind of played both sides of the coin, and how she was smuggled out of her, in disguise, out of her fancy French boarding school. Because at the time, of course, the peasants were rising up. They had been taxed to death. And so they were rising up against the bourgeois class. And the sight of a young wealthy woman fleeing her fancy, fancy boarding school wouldn't have gone over very well. So she was spirited out in disguise by the family dressmaker. And what's so interesting is they had to hide a lot of their wealth. However, her father actually ended up playing both sides of the coin. So he was a wealthy merchant. And then he took up sides with the revolutionaries and actually rose to great political prominence there. So it kind of helped preserve the family fortune. And in those days, you know, the children of rich people married the children of other rich people. And so Barbe Nicole was promised in marriage to a young man named François Clicquot. And the Clicquots, he was the only son of the Clicquot family. And the Clicquots were also one of the largest textile producing families in France. So it was certainly a marriage of convenience, but by all accounts, it was also a marriage of love. And so while Barbe Nicole and François did not have a long marriage, it seemed to be a, you know, a very well-matched one. Now, if you ever see a picture of Madame Clicquot, and if you get this book, you'll see a picture of her on the front cover. I like to say that she was a handsome woman. This book is not so kind. Her younger sister, Clementine, was described as one of the great beauties of the town or the city of Reims. She was not so much. She was very short. She was about 4.5 feet tall. And look, people were shorter back then. They've certainly gotten taller. But in every picture I've ever seen of her, she has kind of this dour countenance, like this grumpy face. And so if you ever open a bottle of Clicquot champagne, the coin or the little metal piece that sits on top of the cork, her portrait is there. And it's a portrait of her from like in her old age when she's like in her 70s or 80s. And so she's definitely looking a little stern there, but she was kind of short and stout and kind of serious looking. So she wasn't the town beauty, but she was really interesting. And this book sets out like right in the beginning, in the prologue, before we even get into kind of her life history, how she was really kind of a woman of contradictions, how she obviously defied the expectations of her culture about who women were and what they were capable of achieving. Because again, like I said, women were often, you know, beautiful side pieces. They were, you know, arm candy. They weren't women who, you know, headed up commercial interests. And so she defied those expectations and she was a real revolutionary, and I'll get into it later, but she innovated tremendously in the world of winemaking, specifically champagne winemaking. And her innovations are still part of, you know, the champagne method or traditional method today. Despite being such a revolutionary and in some ways a rebel, she was also really, really conservative and sometimes really rigid. Her family remained, and she remained, staunchly Catholic, even when religion was outlawed due to the French Revolution. And here's what's crazy. We often talk about this wine as, and I said it already with that quote, how it's, you know, this wine that's associated with women. And I especially talk about this during International Women's Month. And, you know, she was a real revolutionary, but she didn't advocate for the rights of women, even when she lived in an era where feminism was first sort of being born. She was always surrounding herself with men as employees and as business partners, maybe a little bit more, even as friends. She was a really devout mother, and she only had one child named Clementine after her sister. But she also probably undervalued her daughter's intellectual capabilities and excluded her from the family business. And eventually, when Madame Clicquot died at nearly 90 years old, her daughter did not really inherit the winery. She passed it all off to her business partners. She's a woman of contrasts, but she's certainly a fascinating woman. So she marries at a quite young age. She marries François Clicquot. You know, they were a young, wealthy couple. And at this time, you know, a lot of the wines that were being produced in Champagne, they weren't necessarily sparkling. I'm going to go ahead and put a disclaimer in here. This book is about the history of this woman and the rise of the business that she built. It's not a scholarly text on Champagne. There are occasional inaccuracies about Champagne. And look, I'm going to say it now. The author does say sometimes varietal, not variety. But again, this is more like a, you know, a biography as opposed to a reference text about Champagne. So in her youth, you know, in her early 20s, Barbe Nicolle is promised in marriage to François Clicquot. I always think of them as Nikki and Frankie. I don't know if they're like some Jersey couple in my mind, but that's how I always like think of them in my mind. But of course, since religion had been outlawed and she was a strict Catholic, one of the neat things about Clicquot and about certain Champagne producers in the city is that underneath, and there's all these Champagne producers underneath the city, there are all these cellars, and including some subterranean, they're called crayères now, but it's these ancient chalk quarries where in Roman times, several thousand years ago, enslaved people quarried out all of this limestone. It's what was used to build buildings in Reims. And there are now six maisons in Reims. Maison is just the French word for house. It's a Champagne house that actually own these, essentially these crayères, these subterranean excavated quarries. And Clicquot is one of them. And they used to be all interconnected. You could like go from one to the other, like a giant Swiss cheese underneath the city. Now they are very definitely locked up and separated. Like if you're a Tattenjay, like you maybe used to be able to go through a doorway and get to Clicquot, but no more. You're going to have to go back above surface and like go in, you know, down the street and go in the other way. But that's actually where she got married, which is kind of cool. Just because she wanted to get married in a Catholic ceremony, and because of the French Revolution, religion was kind of abolished for a while. And so it's very fitting, I suppose, that her wedding in the start of her married life started underground in a Champagne cellar. Another kind of fascinating little tidbit, and this book is full of them. The city of Reims now is maybe like a quarter of a million people in population, so it's never been that huge of a city. And Champagne has largely been, while there are lots of small producers who are family run, and there are lots of large multinational corporations, it kind of all started off as a family affair. And so it shouldn't be surprising that a lot of these families have some interconnected relations, as it were. And that's true for the Clicquot family. So Barbe Nicolle, which is an interesting name. Nicolle is not that unusual a name. Barbe is the French word for beard, but it's a family name. And as anyone who's ever gotten a family name, you just sometimes you get what you get. So Barbe Nicolle was named after her maternal grandmother, her mother's mother, and her maternal grandmother was named Marie Barbe Nicolle Huart-Letertre. She, Marie Barbe Nicolle, Barbe Nicolle's maternal grandmother, was the daughter of a, wait for it, famous name, Nicolas Runart. Nicolas Runart was already a pretty famous name in Reims because Nicolas Runart was the founder of the Runart Champagne Maison. He was the nephew of a Benedictine monk named Dame Thierry Runart, who was a contemporary of Dom Pierre Perpignan. Are you following along still? Everything is connected. It's all connected. So, I mean, again, it's a winemaking region. This is a couple hundred years ago. It's a bunch of families. It's not surprising, but it's kind of a neat family connection. And so Runart is recognized as the first true Champagne house dedicated to making sparkling wine, because there was a house in Champagne, Gausset, that predated Runart making wine, but they weren't making sparkling wine. So Runart is the very first, established in 1729. So we're coming up on, you know, 300 years in a few years. So Nicolas Runart founded that. So he was Barbe Nicolle's great grandfather. He invented the industry, essentially, and then she would go on to revolutionize it. That's just cool, right? I think that's just a really neat connection. Like I said, the chapters are all organized by kind of chronology. So we start with her youth and the French Revolution, and then her, you know, getting married and being part of the Clicquot family. And interspersed in this are just sort of tidbits to help you recognize how things were in those days. So Champagne wasn't regularly even called Champagne in France until like the mid 1860s. This was a region, it's the furthest north region for wine production in France. It has historically been a really marginal climate for growing grapes, and the wines were not recognized nearly at the same quality as like the wines from further south in Burgundy. But they were making the wines, and it was a robust business. And, you know, this book is not about who invented Champagne. We now know that it was most likely invented and pioneered in both the south of France and by the British. But they were just calling it vermouth, sparkling wine. And largely when it first happened, you know, when wine was sparkling, they thought it was a mistake. They thought it was the devil's wine. Really, it was just incomplete fermentation in bottle. And vermouth or sparkling wine wasn't even possible until wines were bottled, because the predecessor to bottled wines was wines being shipped in and stored in cask. And so you would sell a cask of wine to a private individual or, you know, a merchant, and they would just tap the cask. Can't say that the quality of the wine would have been that delicious, not so fresh. But of course, when you have a large barrel or cask of wine, if it ever was sparkling because of a halted and then recommenced fermentation, that sparkle wouldn't last long. So sparkling wine or vermouth wasn't even really possible until you had bottled wine. Another thing at this time is that the style of wine was very, very different. It was very, very, very sweet. Now, when Madame Clicquot first got into the winemaking business, a lot of the things that we take for granted about champagne just didn't exist and we didn't know about. We know now, and it has been studied and dialed in a very scientific manner, that how do we make champagne? You start off by harvesting grapes and you crush those grapes, and you can either add yeast now, but fermentation would naturally spontaneously occur just due to ambient wild yeast, which would consume the sugar in the grape juice and create alcohol. That's how you get wine. And then for champagne, the way it was, you know, turning out to be sparkling is that it would get really cold in the fall before the yeast had finished eating up all of the sugar. And so they would go dormant. And then when it would warm up in the spring, they would wake up out of dormancy. They would continue to eat what remaining sugar existed. And then one of the byproducts of fermentation is carbon dioxide. And if the wine had been bottled, then that carbon dioxide would be trapped in the bottle. So you'd have sparkling wine. Ultimately, all of these things that were just happening, you know, somewhat by random, were made to be understood, that you could add yeast and you could add sugar and you could create that secondary sparkle. And more to the point, if you add a certain amount of sugar, it is a mathematical correlation to exactly how much pressure and how much sparkle you will get in that bottle. We understand all of this now. It just really wasn't understood that day. We also know that you can intentionally make wine sweet, because when they finish undergoing that secondary fermentation, you can balance out the wine by adding, you know, a little bit of like a wine sugar mixture. And if you're intending to make a very sweet wine, you just add more sugar. And in Madame Clicquot's time, that was all the rage. Sweet wines were everybody's jam. And every now and then you might hear a story, and I remember hearing about it just a couple of years ago, where, you know, at auction or some private collector has managed to get a hold of like a really old bottle of champagne. Oftentimes in shipwrecks, they were loaded down with these huge cellars with amazing wines. You know, a ship sinks and, you know, years later, divers retrieve the cache of wines from the cellar and they sell it at auction for exorbitant amounts of money. And then somebody with lots of money buys this bottle and they open it. And if the wine has not been compromised by seawater and they taste the wine, I've come across people who've had that opportunity before. I have not. And I said, well, what did the wine taste like? And 100% of the time, the wine is sweet. Because if it's really, really old wine, if it's really, really old champagne, that was just the style of the day. How sweet are we talking? Like crazy sweet. People drank champagne as a dessert wine. It was served incredibly cold, almost like a slush. And when Barbe Nicole and Francois were married in the very beginning of the 19th century, before he died, the wines were at least 10 times sweeter than what a demi-sec champagne is today. So we measure the sweetness in champagne based on, we call it residual sugar, sugar that's left over and wasn't fermented into alcohol. Currently, the range for a demi-sec champagne, we measure it in grams of sugar per liter, is 32 to 50 grams per liter of residual sugar. That sounds like a lot when you realize that the majority of champagne is brut or dry, which means it can have anywhere from 0 to 12 grams per liter of residual sugar. In Madame Clicquot's use, it was not uncommon to have champagnes with about 200 grams per liter of residual sugar. And the Russian market, which helped drive the kind of the global boom of champagne, the Russians preferred it even sweeter, oftentimes with about 300 grams per liter of residual sugar. This is sweeter than like Sauternes, right? It might not be quite as sweet as like Tokaj Essentia, but that stuff's sweeter than honey. But it's really, really, really sweet. Like it almost wants to give you like a little bit of a sugar crash just thinking about it. And what's so funny is that today, one of the common objections that I just encounter by virtue of my work that people associate with the wines of Clicquot, specifically their Brut non-vintage, the yellow labels, people say, oh, the wine is sweet. It's not sweet. It's not sweet at all, actually. It's Brut. It's dry. It's got 9 to 10 grams per liter of residual sugar. But just to put it into reference, a Coke, like a Coca-Cola, which clearly did not exist in Madame Clicquot's time, has about 108 grams per liter of residual sugar. So just things change, right? That was legit sweet champagne. I think you would be hard pressed to find. There are a few examples of champagnes that are sweeter than demi-sec. The next level is Dou. I've only ever really heard of one. They're really hard to find, but you can find some demi-sec champagnes. They're not that uncommon and they're really, really tasty, but they are a fraction of how sweet the wines used to be in Madame Clicquot's time. So it's cool to hear about the way she was making wines, but it's important to remember as we're learning all this stuff that even, you know, describing a vintage wine or a particular style of wine, they wouldn't have tasted the way the wines taste now. So like any book that you hear on this podcast, the pairings are ready made. Obviously, you can pop a bottle of champagne while you're sipping on this. Just know that what you're tasting today in no way resembles the kind of wines Madame Clicquot is making. Madame Clicquot is credited with three major innovations in the world of champagne. And I'm not going to lie, only one of them is really talked about in detail in this book, kind of like one and a half. And that's a little bit of a bummer because that's one thing that she's really known for. In addition to being this pioneering widow and taking control over the champagne house and growing the business on an international scale, and we'll get to some of the cool things she did. She developed a few things, again, with her all-male business partners, the succession of them throughout times. She developed a process called riddling or remouage. So the bottles of wine, you know, closed up in her cellars, they would have yeast in them that created the second fermentation and the sparkle. And in her day, and certainly in, you know, in Ruinart's early days, the bottles of champagne, they were kind of cloudy because no one knew how to get the yeast out of the wine. It's completely harmless, but cloudy wine is not as pretty as crystal clear sparkling wine. And so one of her most famous stories is when she has her houseman, because she always had men about the house, as it were, take essentially a table and cut it in half and drill some holes in it and take the bottles of champagne and stick them neck first through those holes, orienting them in a horizontal manner. And then by turning and twisting them from a horizontal to more of a vertical manner, the yeast would collect in the neck of the bottle. So when you open the bottle, some wine will shoot out because it's sparkling wine, its contents under pressure, but the yeast would also be expelled. And so you'd be left with crystal clear sparkling wine. Now, she was shrewd, right? She was a savvy, savvy bee. And so she kept that secret for like 11 years. And then she shared it with the rest of the champagne industry. Now, all champagne is disgorged this way. Sometimes it's by hand, sometimes it's by machine, but this is how champagne is clarified. So check one in the box of like major innovations for the world of champagne. Now, the next one that she did, which is pretty cool. And this is not actually in a chronological order. The first thing that she did, chronologically speaking, is detailed a little bit later in this book. And she was the first producer of champagne to make a vintage dated champagne. And this is pretty cool because historically, again, being really far north, it's a difficult place to grow grapes to make wine. To make a better wine, the tradition largely was just to blend different wines together. And sometimes those could be wines from different grapes or from different vineyards or from different regions and oftentimes different vintages. And this book does detail, in particular, the high quality of the 1811 vintage in Champagne. And she actually, in 1810, bottled a vintage wine, but the most famous happened the next year. They call it the Comet Year. Halley's Comet passed overhead, and certainly superstitious people might attribute the passing by of a comet and the quality of a vintage. But regardless, it was a great year in Champagne. And this book definitely details how there were some great years and some terrible years, to be sure. And so she bottled in 1810 the first vintage dated champagne. And now that's pretty neat because lots of producers certainly make vintage dated champagne. The majority of champagne is not vintage dated. It comes from a blend of wines from different years. But if the circumstances are good, you can make a wine from one harvest. And she was the first person who did that. What made me sad that this book doesn't mention is that there is one of her contributions didn't make it into this book at all, which is kind of a bummer. So I'm just going to lean into the fact that, again, I've visited this maison a couple times and I know these wines well. Her sort of like third great contribution to the world of champagne occurred in 1818. And she was the first person, the first winery to make a rosé champagne in a blended method. So what does that mean? So a rosé wine is just a pink wine. That's just the French word for pink. And Clicquot was not the first producer to make a pink wine. Ruinart likely was the first because they were the first producer, period. But even though they're growing red grapes, Meunier and Pinot Noir, and the only way to get a red wine is to use red grapes because all the color is in the skin, typically producers weren't making rosé wines by utilizing, you know, the skins of the red grapes. They were using berries. They were dyeing the wine pink with berries because they could achieve a deep color and it kind of masked the cloudiness of the yeast in the wine because she hadn't gotten around yet to inventing the riddling clarification process. So that happened in 1816. 1818, she develops blended wine. And this is crazy, right? she's growing all this Pinot Noir. She's like, why don't I just make a red wine with this Pinot Noir and just add some red wine to white wine to make it pink? I know that sounds revolutionary, but no one had done it before her. So we've only been enjoying true blended rosé champagne for a little over 200 years, which is wacky. Like, that's absolutely wacky. Now, there are producers who make rosé champagne in other methods, but she was the first. So, you know, three checks. So riddling or clarification, first dated vintage champagne, and then rosé. So that doesn't really get touched on this book. It's a little bit of a bummer. But again, this is not a scholarly text or a history of champagne. And this is certainly not the first book about champagne that I've ever talked about. And I think all of these things are detailed in plenty of detail in some of the other champagne books. So if you read all these books about champagne that I review, you're going to get a really comprehensive view of this style in this region. Anywho, back to the story of Madame Clicquot's life. And there are some real kind of interesting little stories and things like that. So we've covered her innovations, her early life and her family. And then, of course, the heartbreak of losing her husband so young. And there are some slightly mysterious accounts of his death. All the kind of public record details that he most likely died of typhoid. And of course, at that same time in 1805, there were actually publications that detailed the medicinal qualities with champagne consumption. I don't think if he in fact died of typhoid, champagne would have cured him. That's the beauty of medicine, science, antibiotics. But she was certainly heartbroken. But Madame Clicquot, she went into business with her father-in-law. And she kind of in a connection with the rest of the champagne industry, when she first kind of approached him as wanting to take over the business, it was decided that that would be okay, but she might need a mentor. And so her sort of first mentor in the business was a gentleman whose last name was Fourneau, which might not ring a whole lot of bells in the world of champagne. But the Fourneaus ended up being a father and son. They were winemakers. They worked together with Madame Clicquot for a while. And eventually they went their separate ways. Times were difficult. It wasn't easy to always to sell their wines. And, you know, there were ups and downs, the businesses. Sometimes she would boom, sometimes she would bust. But eventually the Fourneaus went their separate way. And fast forward another maybe 100 years, another pretty famous family in Champagne purchased the winery established by the father and son Fourneau. And that would be the Tattinger family. And so if you think about the trajectory of the world of wineries in Champagne, it's like the third oldest producer in Champagne because it was technically originally established by the Fourneaus. It didn't become known as Tattinger until later on. So, I mean, we're touching on all of the major connections in some really established producers in Champagne. So Madame Clicquot has, you know, as I mentioned, all of these men that surround her. And one of the men that was kind of a constant in her life was her traveling salesman. His name is Louis Bone. And she stayed at home in class. She had a child and she was running the business and he would travel the world. Champagne has always been, since its inception, largely due to her and other industrious contemporaries like Jean-Remy Moët of Moët and Chandon. Sidebar, it is routinely mentioned in this book how much she seemed to dislike Jean-Remy and how they were fierce competitors. And of course, Moët and Chandon and Veuve Clicquot are both producers in the Moët Hennessy portfolio now. And so it's just really funny to think that, like, fast forward a couple hundred years, they're kind of like, they're separate entities entirely, but they're part of the same company, the same larger company. But there was a lot of competition. And so Louis Bone would be out, you know, all over Europe trying to sell the wines and reporting back. Sometimes he was incredibly successful, sometimes a little bit less so. And all champagne was shipped on a ship. And this is pretty dangerous times. We're not talking about temperature controlled container ships, right? We're talking about wines in bottles. The quality of the glass was not great. The wines could certainly, you know, the bottles could break. They could be subject to heat and sun. There's a million things that could go wrong. But one of the things that Madame Clicquot is so famous for, frankly, her risk-taking and her willingness to kind of like flout the laws at the time. So this book does detail the kind of crossroads where Wences is located in northern France. It's really been this crossroads for wars throughout history. Most recently, World War I and World War II, but before that, like the Franco-Prussian War. And there are lots of characters who you've, you know, certainly heard about through your history classes in here, but the Russian markets, they had a thirst for champagne and the only cure was more champagne. And because of wars, those markets were closed. There were blockades. And when the end of the wars were coming about, there's a little detail about how the Tsar, Alexander, had actually ordered Champagne to like fet, you know, 300,000 troops in Champagne, his Russian troops, and that he ordered all the wine from Moët and Chandon. And she was a little chuffed at that. But she foresaw the potential of the opening of the Russian markets. And so she played a little gamble and she sent Louis Bone out with a ship loaded with champagne, with her 1811 excellent vintage champagne, and basically was parking the ship as close to Russia as she could get, anticipating that the markets would open. And as soon as word traveled that they were open, they would be able to sail into Russian ports and sell the champagne. And she gambled correctly. And people went like bananas, like begging to buy this wine. He sold out of everything. It was a huge boom. And here's the crazy part. The gamble was that, one, nothing would happen to the wine during its trip, that they wouldn't get shipwrecked, they wouldn't be hot, the bottles wouldn't be broken. There's a million things that could have gone wrong. I mean, there's always a million things that can go wrong with wine, but in these days, like really a million things. So that was a really huge gamble, but she wanted to be the first one in the markets because once trade was open with Russia, there would be so much competition. And she wanted to, well, she wanted to win that competition. And that she anticipated rather correctly that there would also be a great deal of difficulty in chartering follow-up ships to continually supply the market. Shrewd lady, after sending that first shipment with Louis Bone, unbeknownst to anyone, she actually chartered another ship and had a whole nother shipment of wines ready to go, this time unaccompanied. She didn't have a salesperson there, and it was all queued up. So everyone's all excited. The markets open up. She sells out of all this wine. It's, you know, happy days are here again. People are going crazy. Everybody's scrambling to get a boat. No boats are there to be had. And who should sail right back into Russia but like the next boat of Clicquot champagne? So she was a daredevil and a risk taker. And like, look, I mean, it wasn't legal what she was doing, but I think history tends to forgive that sort of stuff. What is the saying? Ask for forgiveness, not permission. So that's one of her like greatest kind of scandals slash kind of daredevil tales. It's kind of exciting, right? So she's this big innovator. She's this big risk taker. But then there's like some really funny and also kind of some sad family stories. And one of my favorites, and this is one of my favorite things just generally about reading these books, is every now and then while I'm reading these books, I come across a reference for another book that I want to read. It's not always a book that would be suitable for this podcast, but every now and then something comes along. So this is a true story. This is so fascinating to me. So Barb Nicole has this, you know, this one daughter named Clementine, and she is married off to a young man who I guess would be described as kind of a dandy. His name is Louis de Chevigny. And he was like really handsome and really charming. And he also, like, he charmed his mother-in-law. And she basically underwrote his entire like dandy lifestyle. I mean, he didn't really necessarily have much of a vocation. And she didn't invite or bring her daughter or son-in-law into the family business. But he liked to gamble and he liked to party. And he always wanted to build new houses. And she paid for all of it. Because as it says, she maybe had a blind spot for him, that he was like really charming and his charm captivated everybody. So there's this kind of funny story. So he was, you know, I'm going to have to quote from the book. Oddly enough, the other thing that no one could control was Louis de Chevigny's spending habits or his sexuality. So this is her son-in-law. Still gambling, he was always in debt. Considering he was a rich man with a mother-in-law who was bankrolling his lifestyle, he must have been reliably unlucky. So not a good gambler. He clearly didn't pick up on his mother-in-law's skills in that regard. So what was an idle aristocrat to do but turn his passions to account? Apart from gambling, he had three passions. They were, this is so good, wearing fancy clothes, writing bad poetry, and acting the playboy. So this is really funny. He had these good looks. He had all this money from his mother-in-law. He had these good clothes, and his wealth had allowed him this like leisurely lifestyle to indulge in the pleasures of poetry. And one of the things that he did, indulging in this passion, was to translate some classical Latin poems. And they had been very politely received by his, you know, contemporaries. However, Louis de Chevigny found that his friends found his bawdy verses very witty. Impromptu poetic toasts were one of his social hallmarks, and he had been very privately collecting some of his better little compositions. So he'd have these parties, and he'd be obviously toasting with a lot of champagne, spending all of his mother-in-law's money. And he would like, I mean, imagine like dirty limericks, right? Like there once was someone from Nantucket, like sort of this idea, right? This is kind of the idea. These bawdy lyrics, they were social toasts, and he started collecting them. In the first years of his marriage to Clementine, he had just regaled his friends with the private details, and they had written to ask for more. So he had turned his hand to writing erotic verse, which was meant to be both philosophical and rakish. Sadly, Louis was not much of a poet, but lack of talent never stopped a rich man from publishing. In 1836, Louis had first published some of his erotic poems with the press in France in a volume called Les Contes Rois, or The Tales of France. One review sums up his talents quite eloquently. These, quote, imitations of Boccaccio and La Fontaine have none of the wit and grace, but all of the grossness of those authors. For Clementine, it was embarrassing. So I just want to put this out there. I bought that book. First thing I did when I came across this, I was like, oh my God, is that book, has it been reprinted? So I did an internet search. It has been. It took like 4 weeks to get. It's all in French. And while I studied French for a long time, I haven't set about translating it, but I was just like, what? A book of erotic poetry written by Madame Clicquot's son-in-law? Must order. So I'm not going to do a podcast on that, but just, I thought it was really funny. So I just wanted to share that little tidbit with you all. And maybe once I finally get around to reading it, I will, maybe I'll make some off-color toasts about some of his erotic poetry at a dinner party soon to happen in the future. Who's to say? So anyway, the book goes on and kind of details when Madame Clicquot, she gets a little bit on in years, and eventually she turns the family business over to her longtime business partner. And she lived, I believe, to the ripe old age of like 89, which in her time was exceptionally old. She had a very long and very full life. She never remarried. The book alludes occasionally to maybe perhaps one of these business partners maybe was a little bit more of a partner in some ways, but she never remarried, and she was this famous widow, and she became known as La Grande Dame de Champagne, so the Great Lady of Champagne. Obviously, I've mentioned some of her big contributions. She built in her lifetime what was once kind of a small novel, like side hustle for the family, into a huge, like, juggernaut that really paved the way for much of Champagne. And so her impact on the industry, it can never be denied, let alone diminished. I mean, what she did was really huge. And I think it's just really neat to think about not only what she did, but when she did it, because certainly the odds were against her. Now, look, she had a lot of privilege. She was a rich, educated woman. So she did have privileges that certainly many women were not afforded at the time. But her biggest obstacle was that she was a woman. And the book does detail lots of other famous or not famous widows who were her contemporaries, including Queen Victoria and other widows in Champagne. She's not the only veuve. There are other veuve, you know, Veuve Fournier and other producers in Champagne. And there's kind of a sad observation that maybe one thing that all these women had in common is that they were able to achieve kind of exceptional levels in business and industry and innovation. But what allowed them to achieve that was the fact that they were widowed. And so perhaps they wouldn't have wished for that, but it is sort of this like sad commonality. But maybe that fact was what allowed them to achieve such greatness. So it's a little bit sad. It's all true. It's a little bit dirty. It's a little bit funny. It's a little bit illegal. And it's a little bit delicious. Actually, screw that. It's a lot delicious. We love champagne. And it's my favorite beverage. Most sommeliers love it. And this book does a really good job of talking about it. So what works? Well, I mean, this is not that long of a book. And it's a pretty fast read. And I do appreciate how it details, you know, history of what was happening. It talks about the Napoleonic Wars and the Franco-Prussian War and the French Revolution. And if you haven't taken or don't remember your French history, like, you can't divorce the history of France or any wine producing nation from the history of wine production. They're inextricably linked. And so I think it's an important timeline. It's not a scholarly text, but it does have a lot of details about the history of a producer who, I think, to be honest, most people currently are probably just, they recognize these wines, they're drinking these wines because they recognize the color of the label. By the way, there's kind of a cool story about that. For what it's worth, in Madame Clicquot's time, bottles weren't fancy the way that they are fancy now. They didn't have the labels and the foil and all that good. So when I mentioned that the Russian market had this appetite for crazy sweet champagne, that's true. But there was a growing demand from the British market for a drier style of champagne. So she had to accommodate that because champagne has long been a wine that's been exported. And so she needed a way to indicate a drier style. And if you've been in wine cellars, particularly in champagne cellars, the lamps that are in there are these kind of like sulfur bulbs and they have this yellowish glow. So she needed something that would distinguish the plain bottle that you could tell in this very dim kind of yellowy light. So the best that, you know, a historian at the Maison can infer is that in her time, in addition to sort of the symbols of the house, the anchor, which is sort of a family symbol, and it meant a few things to them, or the comet, which was, of course, a symbol of that great vintage. They might have had just really simple plain white labels, and she needed to indicate something to signify this drier wine. So she created what's called the carte jaune, the yellow label. And this is where the color of the Jaune d'œuf came forward. And so it was a way to signify the drier wine for the British market. Now we know the yellow label is a Brut non-vintage, and Brut is a dry wine. And they do make a demi-sec. It's the sweeter style, and it has more of the throwback traditional white label. So there's a little bit of like history that never stops. Like you can't deny it. You kind of can't get away from it. And even if all you know of this wine is like a recognizable yellow label, there's so much cool backstory for it that this book does a really good job in filling in some of those gaps. What doesn't work? I mean, sometimes the details are a little boring. Like there were some laugh aloud funny times, like the dirty poetry or, you know, her scandal and her running of the blockades and like cue up the second ship that she had already, you know, had on deck. Like there's some really cool stuff, but there sometimes it drags a little bit. And it's not, you know, it's a biography. It's not a scholarly text. So every now and then, me being the picky book reviewer, there are some inaccuracies. So it's not a perfect book, but it's a really interesting book. So for my rating, I think this is a buy. Look, Veuve Clicquot is the second largest producer of champagne in the region. It is one of the most recognized wines in the world. And while many people, in fact, probably most consumers, don't care anything about anything besides what the wine tastes like, I think with these historic producers, there's just so much to know and to get and to love and to laugh about that, like, if you are listening to this podcast, you like wine and you like books, and this is a book that combines them in such a true and interesting way, and to really flesh out some all true details. It's all fascinating. I think it's a really great way to get some backstory. It's not perfect. So you shouldn't use this as you're learning about champagne as a style of wine book. You should read this book as a learning more about the history of one of the most impactful producers that we know of. So I think this is a buy. And again, can't stop, won't stop. It's got a built-in wine pairing. There's so many great wines that you can, you know, pop a cork of and sip along while you read this. And it's only 191 pages, so it's a pretty quick read. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this. I sure did. It's a fun read. It's frankly making me thirsty for some champagne. And I guess I want some lobster salad too. I'll just eat that in the privacy of my own home. But it's a fun read. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. Please be sure to subscribe. And hey, look, if you like what you heard, feel free to give us a rating. See you next week.
This episode was brought to you by Study Hall, my show on Somm TV, where you can learn the ins and outs of being a sommelier and get helpful hints and tips for studying for all your exams. Get a year of Somm TV for only $25 with the code STUDYHALL.